In that beautiful ending to what Rita was reading, which are lines from the autobiography of a yogi, the chapter, A Vision of Cosmic Consciousness, which if you haven't read that book or haven't read that chapter recently, I send you to it and tell you, you'll have a great experience. The last lines there were, Master says, his use of language is so interesting. I cognize the center of the empyrean as a point of intuitive perception in my own heart. And then he says, of all of these rays, you know, radiating out from that point. And first he's describing this incredible glory that he's perceiving of universes being manifested and all these dancing rays of light and beauty and bliss and taking all these different forms, sextillion rays of whatever it is, forming and unforming. I mean, when you just sort of sit there for a moment and imagine what it would be like to just be looking around this room and instead of seeing all the individual bodies or the walls of this building, to see sextillion rays of infinite light forming and unforming universes around us. And the remarkable thing about it is that it's not as if we would have to go somewhere and be someone else for this to happen. We don't go into some great chamber somewhere where this is taking place. It entirely depends on our level of perception when we look out what we see. And that's where Master's phrase, I cognize that the center of this whole extraordinary story was emanating from a point of intuitive perception in my own heart. Now you see, that's the essence of scripture altogether. That's the essence of self-realization, that everything that we experience emanates from our intuitive perception in our own heart, that the whole thing radiates out from here. Now, wrongly understood, that makes us rather proud of the whole story, doesn't it? And there is a certain kind of right-wrong spiritual understanding that starts saying, well, you know, you're all just minions of my own consciousness. And instead of making us humble, this teaching in the wrong hands makes people, well, very fat-headed, you know, just big and important. And that's why Swamiji and Master always say, it's better not to say, I am God, but to say rather, God lives in me. Even though it's accurate to say, I am God, it's a little dicey. And we don't really want to put ourselves sort of out there until we've purged, deeply purged from every element of our being, any misunderstanding of that pronoun I. A great deal of the difficulty that people have had reading the Bible and understanding it from the highest level has been because Jesus used the pronoun I a great deal. And he really did mean it in two ways, but he never meant it in terms of the exclusive reality of his individual body. He did mean I, this individualized expression of the Spirit serving as a pure channel of the divine, because Jesus was and is a divine guru with his own disciples, and in the way of discipleship, he serves as the window through which individuals who have that karmic relationship escape from the building into the infinite, so to speak. We look in this room, and in fact, we actually have seven identical windows, and each of them could take us out of the confines of this building. And it might be the one you're sitting closest to, if there was an emergency here or whatever it might be. But we could escape through each of those windows. But then the reality would be, in this case, I mean, you would just be in the parking lot here, but in the image that I'm trying to use, which is not really a lot of progress, I think you're better off inside. But still, to escape from the confines of ego. Now that's something really worth doing, because this intuitive perception that we have within us is also enslaved by the limitations of our sense of personal identity and the world simply as we're capable of seeing it. Swamiji made the interesting comment once, which I've seen demonstrated in his life over and over again. But he was saying that he sees everyone. We were visiting with him, as you all know, for the first 2 weeks almost of February. We were in India with him, and we were sitting at the table one night, and there was about 16 people there, and it was pretty much evenly divided, men and women. I don't know, somehow we started talking about gender, and Swami just made the comment, which I have observed in him many times. You know, there's an interesting comment about gender. Gender, I've heard it said, is the first thing you notice about a person and the last thing you forget. When you can't remember any other characteristics, you'll still generally know whether you've been in the company of a man or a woman. You know, when the police ask you to identify your assailant, you'll generally know whether it was a man or a woman, even if you didn't remember anything else. But Swamiji just made the comment that he no longer notices whether people are male or female. And when you really think about it, it's such a superficial difference. You know, just this little bit of a face, this little bit of a body, a few defining characteristics that we're all aware of, you know. But really, so superficial compared to all the ways in which we are the same, especially as we come closer and closer to our own divine reality. A lovely image that I really like to think about when we're trying to think about male and female is the symbol of the yin-yang, the Chinese symbol, which is the perfect circle, and two identical parts of it, which are shaped in an interesting way, like paisleys, black and white, and they fit together in this way. But you really can't say which is one and which is the other. Swamiji also often talks about two sides of a coin. Male and female are like two sides of a coin. You can't really say that the male side has more worth than the female side because it's just one coin. You can't go either way with it. And our true goal, spiritually speaking, step by step, is to dissolve all of these differences, to become, we seek a mate who's balancing to us. You know, whether it's gender balance or personality balance or whatever, but we seek somehow to find wholeness by merging as much as we can with the individuals around us, loving our children, loving our friends, serving those that we serve in business or as parents or as teachers, whatever it might be. We try to take the boundaries of ourselves and expand them and take in the reality really of as many other individuals as we can for the sake of expanding our own sense of self-identity. And as we move deeper and deeper on the spiritual path, we come more and more into the center of that male-female continuum too. So even the yogis say that if as a soul evolves, as a man evolves spiritually, as he develops deeper and deeper devotion, he may actually begin to grow breasts. And sometimes you see in very advanced yogis that they have breasts like about a puberty girl, you know, like about a 13-year-old girl. You'll see on their bare chest just little breasts, because the reason females have this concentration of energy here, which nurtures children and in so many ways defines a female, is because the female has a concentration of feeling. The feminine energy is a concentration of feeling in the heart. And men tend to have a stronger forehead and a more defined energy here, because the definition of masculine is willpower. And I don't want to say the definition of a man or a woman, but masculine and feminine. And generally we get a body that is inclined in whatever direction we're trying to balance. But it's just a starting point of trying to come right to the center. And the more we ourselves come to the center in this extremely fundamental sense of self-identity, it's just one of the many different ways in which we practice changing the intuitive perception of the heart, so that more and more when we look out on this world, instead of seeing all these bits and pieces and contradictory parts, and instead of having within ourselves all of these deeply defined self-imposed attitudes and then projecting them out on the world, I was starting to say, Swamiji remarked once that when he looks out at the world and he sees sentient beings of all kinds, including animals, he said it all looks just the same to him. It doesn't mean that he can't tell a turtle from a human being, but there is a certain truth to that, In the Bhagavad Gita, it talks about how a man of enlightenment looks at a piece of gold and a clod of clay, and it looks just the same to him. Because all of the human lust and avarice for that gold and the power and the illusion that it will give them some inner happiness is just purged from the yogi's mind. All of his understanding of inner happiness comes completely from the awareness of that intuitive center within himself from which radiates everything. Even the gold itself is just sextillion rays all playing out. It's nothing but a pattern of energy. And if that pattern of energy emanates from our own heart and we live at the point of emanation, then what difference does it make how it presents itself? You see? This is the Bhagavad Gita describes the final result, is that there's just complete calm acceptance of whatever you see, because it really all looks the same. Swamiji was saying again about consciousness of individuals. He says it's just a continuum of ego. Just self, deep self-identity with the individual physical form gradually expanding until all sense of identity with anything separate from the infinite is completely dissolved. And at each of those stages, the incarnate being, whatever body it's incarnated, whether it's an enthusiastic puppy or a great scientist or a magnificent doctor or a fabulous musician, whatever it is, it lives in the world that it's capable of seeing. Isn't that so? When Swamiji was once very engaged, this was when he was writing the oratorio. Swamiji is a multi-talented person. Swami, for the few of you who are brand new, is the founder of our community. I've been talking to him continuously because most of you know him. He's an American man. He's in his early 80s now. And he's multi-talented in many fields, and he's managed to accomplish very pointedly in all of those fields, he says, which many multi-talented people get too diverse. But he does that by when he's doing one thing, he does it completely. And when he was writing the oratorio, which is this beautiful musical composition of many songs about the life of Christ, when he was engaged in writing that, he was so deeply immersed in music that when you would talk to him in words, he would look sort of puzzled at you. As someone said, he sort of would look at human beings and try to decide whether they were a major or a minor key. And he would almost like he would take words and he would have to translate it into melody before he could understand what you'd said. You know, most of the time when he's writing, he's very verbally acute. And when he says he's writing a book, he says he can't ever imagine writing music again. It just seems so outside of his realm of consciousness. And once, just speaking of men and women, there was a period of time when he wrote these little books called Secrets of Success, Friendship, Happiness, Inner Peace. And he'd written we were making a lot of money. Ananda was making really nice money off of those books. And the salesman said, look, these books are bought almost entirely by women. If you wrote a Secrets for Women, it would sell really well. And Swami said, I can't write that. And then the next morning, he said he woke up and he said he was completely immersed in feminine consciousness. And for 3 days, it's just 30, one for every month, he wrote these 30 aphorisms, Secrets for Women. And he said, and during that time, he said he felt just completely like a female person. And people called him for various decisions. And he said, I can't give you any answers, because he said it would require they require that I have male energy. He said, and I don't have any right now. And so then he finished writing it, and he came out of it. And you have to understand that Swami hasn't an ounce of prejudice for what I'm about to say. Then he came to some of us in female bodies, and he said, for 3 days I just lived as a woman. He said, it was terrible. He said, just waves of feeling, one after the other, after the other. He said, I really prefer being a man. You know, and women are always trying so desperately. I've done a lot of marriage counseling in my life, couples counseling, and I gradually began to see the pattern, because it's usually the women who come to speak to me, of course, because they're the ones who have all the feelings about things. And I gradually realized that what they were asking is if there was some way we could turn their husband into a woman. Because everything in the relationship was perfect except about this much, you know, just about 2 inches, which is just the difference between male and female. You know, why doesn't he express his feelings more? Why isn't he aware of all these little things? Doesn't he know how important it would be if? No, not actually, he doesn't. And even more than that, he doesn't want to know. You know, it's not attractive to him to be waxing and waning and waxing and waning all the time, you know? Male energy is put your mind on the goal and who cares how you feel. It's a good thing for women to learn too, with all due respect, you know, because both are needed. Of course, if you insensitively run over people and have no idea that they're weeping by the wayside, that's not such a good idea either. But you know, women's constant preoccupation with the minutiae is not such a good idea either. And we're born because this is what we have to learn one way or another. We need to learn to overcome all of these little likes and dislikes, all of these little preferences, because you see, all of reality emanates from a point of intuitive perception in the heart. And the heart is also the chakra in which all of these likes and dislikes exist. This is the picture of how creation was made. You see, this great, isn't this a great image? It doesn't mean anything, of course, but everything is one. In the end, it all merges into this infinite oneness, Sat Chit Ananda, infinite perfect bliss, ever existing. But as the scriptures explain, as the yogis explain, God's consciousness vibrates. This is what the physicists are discovering. There's this vibration of energy that results in this apparent reality. And the oddest thing is the more they go into that, just objectively with instruments of perception that are based on the senses looking out, they keep noticing that it's just this oscillating energy. And of course, for ages, this is what the scriptures have been telling us. The word, the vibration of Om, the light, the vibration of light. And it moves like this. And just like a fan, when it spins really fast, it looks like a solid one object, doesn't it? Something in motion looks solid. The wind blows. It feels like something happening. But really, it's just oneness vibrating. And so we go here and we like this and we're male, and then we go here and we're female and we like that, and we go here and we are happy about this and we go there and we're sad about that. But really, what we're trying to do is just bring all those vibrations in the heart to a point of infinite stillness. And then all of a sudden we realize it's just irradiating out from our own inner reality. And this is why when you read the Bhagavad Gita, it just says over and over again, just looking at this world, it's not about the differences, it's about the sameness. Now there's an important point there that Sri Yukteswar, in Autobiography of a Yogi, and when he was training Yogananda in the spiritual teachings, he said it this way. He said, saintliness is not dumbness. It's not that the more sensitively we perceive, the stupider we become in the ways of the world. When the yogi looks, the man of enlightenment looks at the clod of clay and the bar of gold and sees no difference, it's not because he doesn't know there's a difference. You know, children are so delightfully dumb. You know, they just don't know anything about anything. You give them an expensive toy and their passion is for the box because they don't have any, I mean, it may be, they might find the box more interesting than whatever it was that you gave them. It's just because they don't have all those values in place, but it's because they haven't, it's not because they've transcended them. It's because they're just so new to the planet that they haven't figured out exactly what's going on here. They're still Martians, so to speak. They just look at this planet, none of the rules actually apply. But the saintly person has actually won the battle of all the temptations that all these apparent differences exert over the mind. You know, the temptation to think that I'm going to find the perfect partner, and once I have that partner, then I will always be happy. You know? It's a very powerful drive to find your mate. That's part of the yin-yang energy. And it's not something that we can stand aside from. It's the yoga, Sri Yukteswar also described it. The heart compels us into close relationships with people because the soul wisdom says you're not going to learn any other way. You know, it's only after we have advanced to a certain point that we have sufficient self-knowledge that we can resolve the remaining issues only within ourselves. For many stages of the purification of the heart, Jesus says, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." Well, how do we get to that purity? We purge out of ourselves all elements that are not divine. And we don't just give those up casually. We don't just wake up in the morning, tie a little string around our finger. Oh yes, see everything equally now. Clod of clay, piece of gold, same. Yes, tie a little string around my finger. You know, we need more than just a concept, because our responses happen faster than our concepts. Even if we have very quick minds, whatever is the actual perception of where our happiness comes from just swings out there immediately, just as fast as it can be. I was driving down the freeway not too long ago, and there was just one of those split-second moments, which actually is over before it happens, where it seemed like somebody was going to smash into me and something really notable was going to happen. And it just came and went like that. But I observed, as soon as it was over, my heart was pounding. I was like this, and I thought, well, so much for your philosophy. You know, in Autobiography of a Yogi, they tell this remarkable story about how a burly policeman was pursuing a dangerous criminal, and the criminal had disguised himself in the robes of a sadhu. He was dressed, he'd put on an orange robe, and so the policeman saw someone dressed like that who fit exactly the description of the criminal, and he started chasing the man. "Stop, stop! In the name of the police, stop, stop!" And the sadhu just kept on indifferently, and finally the policeman was convinced that this was the man, and this is the story, it's told, it's a true story. He had a machete, and he actually hacked at the man, the yogi, and cut off his arm. And the yogi just very calmly turned, just think of this, picked up the arm, stuck it like this, and by his yogic powers just healed it, and said to the policeman very calmly, "I'm not the one you're seeking." You know? And then just went on. Now, it gives us something to aspire to, doesn't it? I mean, I wasn't even hit by the car. I was just threatened. And no matter how brilliantly I can talk about the oneness of all things, in that moment, I was scared to death for the death of my body. You know, and in how many ways? It's humbling. It's very, very pleasantly humbling. When the Loma Prieta earthquake happened here, however many years ago that was, I was sitting in one of the little apartment that we lived in the community at that time, and the whole building, you know, began to just rattle and shake. And I became convinced there is no such thing as an earthquake-proof building. There's just shorter and longer earthquakes. That's really all there is. But the building's going like this. And my response was, like that, and I just ran out of the building in a split second. One of my friends said later, "Oh, as soon as the earth began to shake, I said, Om Guru, Om Guru." I said, "I didn't." You know, there was quite a few seconds passed before it occurred to me that my life was in God's hands. For that moment, my life was in my hands. Right. So we need to be humble about this. But we also have to work steadfastly, assiduously, moment by moment. Last night, some of you were here and I was talking about this. The moments are more important than the years. Moment by moment by moment, we need to look at this world at as high a vibration as we can sincerely meet. It doesn't serve us to try to impose on our actual consciousness something that looks better, you know. That makes me look like a yogi. Nobody is fooled. Your friends are not fooled. Your consciousness is not fooled. And really, believe me, God is not fooled. Amused, yes. But fooled, no. Right? Just like little children. When I was 7 years old, my mother sent me to sleepaway camp. And I was the youngest child in the camp. And everybody made these pot holders by taking elasticized bands and putting them on this little loom and weaving them together. Probably all of you have done that too. I could never make any potholders. Mine just came out like this. And the parents' day, we had two bunks, and I was in the lower bunk, and the girl above me, her name was Rainy, her first name. She had her potholders all hung there, and I just had nails. So I took a couple of hers and put them on mine. Which, of course, did not please her, as you could well imagine. And what I remember, you know, a tiny little child curled up on my mother's lap. Bless my mother for this. She's holding me, and I'm sobbing. They fell. They fell. I kept saying. You know, I'm sure my mother was between tears and laughter. Of course they didn't fall, you little twit. You took them. But she understood why I had done it. You see, God is amused. God holds us in his arms while we weep. But he's not fooled. So we have to be just exactly who we are. That is the single hardest thing on the path, is to have the courage to be exactly who we are, to be as amused as God is amused, and still to feel his loving arms around us. Bless you.